and I stepped clear of her to greet Hap. "So, lad, how was it? Did a Buckkeep Springfest live up to Starling's tales?"
"It was good," he said, neutrally.
He gave me one full look, and his mismatched eyes, one brown, one blue, were full of torment. "Hap?" I began concernedly, but he shrugged away from me before I could touch his shoulder. He walked away from me, but perhaps he regretted his surly greeting, for a moment later he croaked,
"I'm going to the stream to wash. I'm covered in road dust."
"Go with him. I'm not sure what's wrong, but he needs a friend."
"Preferably one that can't ask questions,"
Night Eyes agreed. Head low, tail straight out, he followed the boy. In his own way, he was as fond of Hap as I was, and had had as much to do with his raising. When they were almost out of eyeshot, I turned back to Starling. "Do you know what that was about?" She shrugged a twisted smile on her lips. "He's 15. Does a sullen mood have to be about anything at that age? Don't bother yourself over it. It could be anything. A girl at Springfest that didn't kiss him, or one that did. Leaving Buckkeep or coming home, a bad sausage for breakfast. Leave him alone. He'll be fine." I looked after him, as he and the wolf vanished into the trees. "Perhaps I remember being 15 a bit differently from you," I commented. I saw to her horse and Clover the pony, while Starling went into the cottage, reflecting, as I did so, that no matter what my mood, Burrick would have ordered me to see to my horse before I wandered off. Well, I was not Burrick, I thought to myself. I wondered if he held the same line of discipline with Nettle and chivalry and Nim as he had with me, and then wish I had asked Chade the rest of his children's names. By the time the horses were comfortable, I was wishing that Chade had not come. His visit had stirred too many old memories to the surface. Resolutely, I pushed them away. "Bones 15 years old," the wolf would have told me. I touched minds with him briefly. Hap had splashed some water on his face and strode off into the woods, muttering and walking so carelessly that there was no chance they'd see any game. I sighed for them both and went into the cottage. Inside, Starling had dumped the contents of her saddlebags on the table. Her discarded boots were lying across the doorsill. Her cloak festooned a chair. The kettle was just starting to boil. She stood on a stool before my cupboard. As I came in, she held out a small brown crock to me. "Is this tea any good still? It smells odd." "It's excellent when I'm in enough pain to choke it down. Come down from there." I set my hands to her waist and lifted her easily, though the old scar on my back gave a twinge as I set her on the floor. "Sit, I'll make the tea. Tell me about Springfest." So she did, while I clattered out my few cups, cut slices from my last loaf and put the rabbit stew to warm. Her tales of Buckkeep were the kind I had become accustomed to hearing from her. She spoke of minstrels who had performed well or badly, gossiped of lords and ladies I had never known, and condemned or praised food from various nobles' tables where she had guested. She told each tale wittily, making me laugh or shaking my head as it called for, with nary a pang of the pain that Chade had wakened in me. I supposed it was because he had spoken of the folk we had both known and loved, and told his stories from that intimate perspective. It was not Buckkeep itself or city life that I pined for, but for my childhood days and the friends I had known. In that I was safe. It was impossible to return to that time. Only a few of those folk even knew that I still lived, and that was as I wished it to be. I said as much to Starling. "Sometimes your tales tug at my heart and make me wish I could return to Buckkeep, but that is a world closed to me now." She frowned at me. "I don't see why." I laughed aloud. "You don't think anyone would be surprised to see me alive?"
She cocked her head and stared at me, frankly.
"I think there would be few, even of your old friends, who would recognize you. Most recall you as an unscarred youth. The broken nose, the slash down your face, even the white in your hair might alone be disguise enough. Then you dressed as a prince's son. Now you wear the garb of a peasant. Then you move with a warrior's grace. Well, now, in the mornings or on a cold day, you move with an old man's caution."
She shook her head with regret as she added,
"You have taken no care for your appearance, nor have the years been kind to you. You could add 5 or even 10 years to your age, and no one would question it."
This blunt appraisal from my lover stung. "Well, that's good to know."
I replied wryly. I took the kettle from the fire, not wanting to meet her eyes just then. She mistook my words and tone.
Yes, and when you add in that people see what they expect to see, and that they do not expect to see you alive, I think you could venture it. Are you considering a return to Buckkeep, then?
No. I heard the shortness of the word, but could think of nothing to add to it. It did not seem to bother her.
A pity. You miss so much living alone like this.
She launched immediately into an account of the Springfest dancing. Despite my soured mood, I had to laugh at her account of Chade, beseeched to dance by a young admirer of 16 summers. She was right. I would have loved to have been there. As I prepared food for all of us, I found my mind straying to the old torment of, what if? What if I had been able to return to Buckkeep with my queen and starling? What if I had come home to Molly and our child? And always, no matter how I twisted the pretense, it ended in disaster. If I had returned to Buckkeep alive when all believed me executed for the practicing of the wit, I would have brought only division at a time when Cotricon was trying to reunify the land. There would have been a faction who would have favoured me over her, for bastard though I was a farseer by blood, when she reigned only by virtue of marriage. A stronger faction would have been in favour of executing me again, and more thoroughly. And if I had gone back to Molly and the child, returned to carry her off to be mine? I suppose I could have. If I had no care for anyone but myself. She and Burrick had both given me up for dead. The woman who had been my wife in all but name, and the man who had raised me and been my friend, had turned to one another. He had kept a roof over Molly's head, and seen that she was fed and warm while my child grew within her. With his own hands he had delivered my bastard. Together they had kept Nettle from Regal's men. Burrick had claimed both woman and child as his own, not only to protect them, but to love them. I could have gone back to them, to make them both faithless in their own eyes. I could have made their bond a shameful thing. Burrick would have left Molly and Nettle to me. His harsh sense of honour would not have allowed him to do otherwise. And ever after, I could have wondered if she compared me to him, if the love they had shared was stronger and more honest than...
You're burning the stew!
Starling pointed out in annoyance.
I was.
I served us from the top of the pot and joined her at the table. I pushed all pasts, both real and imagined, aside. I did not need to think of them. I had Starling to busy my mind. As was customary, I was the listener, and she was the teller of tales. She began a long account of some upstart minstrel at Springfest who had not only dared to sing one of her songs, with only a verse or two changed, but then had claimed ownership of it. She gestured with her bread as she spoke, and almost managed to catch me up in the story. But my own memories of other spring fests kept intruding. Had I lost all content in the simple life I had created for myself? The boy and the wolf had been enough for me for many years. What ailed me now? I went from that to yet another discordant thought. Where was Hap? I had brewed tea for the three of us and portioned out food for three as well. Hap was always ravenous after any sort of task or journey. It was distracting that he could not get past his bad mood to come and join us. As Starling spoke on, I found my eyes straying repeatedly to his untouched bowl of stew. She caught me at it.
"Don't fret about him," she told me almost testily. "He's a boy, with a boy's sulky ways. When he's hungry enough, he'll come in."
"Or he'll ruin perfectly good fish by burning it over a fire."
The wolf's thought came in response to my wit-questing towards him. They were down by the creek. Hap had made a temporary spear out of a stick, and the wolf had simply plunged into the water to hunt along the undercut banks. When the fish ran thick, it was not difficult for him to corner one there, to plunge his head under the water and seize it in his jaws. The cold water made his joints ache, but the boy's fire would soon warm him. They were fine.
"Don't worry."
Useless advice, but I pretended to take it. We finished eating, and I cleared the dishes away. While I tidied, Starling sat on the hearth by the evening fire, picking at her harp until the random notes turned into the old song about the miller's daughter. When everything was put to rights, I joined her there with a cup of sansedge brandy for each of us. I sat in a chair, but she sat near the fire on the floor. She leaned back against my legs as she played. I watched her hands on the strings, marking the crookedness where once her fingers had been broken, as a warning to me. At the end of her song, I leaned down and kissed her. She kissed me back, setting the harp aside and making a more thorough job of it. She stood then and took my hands to pull me to my feet. As I followed her into my bedroom, she observed, "You're pensive tonight." I made some small sound of agreement, sharing that she had bruised my feelings earlier would have seemed snivelling and childish. Did I want her to lie to me, to tell me that I was still young and comely, when obviously I was not? Time had had its way with me. That was all, and to be expected. Even so, Starling kept coming back to me. Through all the years, she'd kept returning to me and into my bed. That had to count for something. "You were going to tell me about something," she prompted. Later, I told her. The past clutched at me, but I put its greedy fingers aside, determined to immerse myself in the present. This life was not so bad. It was simple and uncluttered, without conflict. Wasn't this the life I had always dreamed of? A life in which I made my decisions for myself. And I was not alone, really. I had Night Eyes and Hap and Starling when she came to me. I opened her vest and then her blouse to bare her breasts while she unbuttoned my shirt. She embraced me, rubbing against me with the unabashed pleasure of a purring cat. I clasped her to me and lowered my face to kiss the top of her head. This, too, was simple, and all the sweeter that it was. My freshly stuffed mattress was deep and fragrant as the meadow grass and herbs that filled it. We tumbled onto it. For a time, I stopped thinking at all, as I tried to persuade both of us that despite appearances, I was a young man still. A while later, I lingered in the hinterlands of sleep. Sometimes I think there is more rest in that place between wakefulness and sleep than there is in true sleep. The mind walks in the twilight of both states and finds the truths that are hidden alike by daylight and dreams. Things we are not ready to know abide in that place, awaiting that unguarded frame of mind. I came awake. My eyes were open, studying the details of my darkened room before I realized that sleep had fled. Starling's wide-flung arm was across my chest. In her sleep, she had kicked the blanket away from both of us. Night hid her careless nakedness, cloaking her in shadows. I lay still, hearing her breathe and smelling her sweat mixed with her perfume, and wondered what had wakened me. I could not put my finger on it, yet neither could I close my eyes again. I slid out from under her arm and stood up beside my bed. In the darkness, I groped for my discarded shirt and leggings. The coals of the hearth fire gave hesitant light to the main room, but I did not linger there. I opened the door and stepped barefoot into the mild spring night. I stood still for a moment, letting my eyes adjust, and then made my way away from the cottage and garden and down to the stream bank. The path was cool, hard mud underfoot, well packed by my daily trips to fetch water. The trees met overhead and there was no moon, but my feet and my nose knew the way as well as my eyes did. All I had to do was follow my wit to my wolf. Soon I picked out the orange glow of Hap's dwindled fire and the lingering scent of cooked fish. They slept by the fire, the wolf curled nose to tail and Hap wrapped around him, his arm around Night Eye's neck. Night Eye opened his eyes as I approached, but did not stir.
"I told you not to worry."
"I'm not worried, I'm just here." Hap had left some sticks of wood near the fire. I added them to the coals. I sat and watched the fire lick along them. Light came up with the warmth. I knew the boy was awake. One can't be raised with a wolf without picking up some of his wariness. I waited for him. "It's not you. Not just you, anyway." I didn't look at Hap, even when he spoke. Some things are better said to the dark. I waited. Silence can ask all the questions where the tongue is prone only to ask the wrong one. "I have to know," he burst out suddenly. My heart seized up at the question to come. In some corner of my soul, I had always dreaded him asking it. I should not have let him go to Springfest, I thought wildly. If I had kept him here, my secret would never have been threatened. But that was not the question he asked.
Did you know that Starling is married? I looked at him then, and my face must have answered for me. He closed his eyes in sympathy. I'm sorry, he said quietly. I should have known you didn't. I should have found a better way to tell you. And the simple comfort of a woman who came to my arms when she would, because she desired to be with me, and the sweet evenings of tales and music by the fire, and her dark, merry eyes looking up into mine were suddenly guilty and deceptive and furtive. I was as foolish as I had ever been. No, even stupider. For the gullibility of a boy is fatuousness in a man. Married. Starling, married. She had thought no one would ever want to marry her, for she was barren. She had told me that she had to make her own ways with her songs, for there would never be a man to care for her, nor children to provide for her old age. Probably when she had told me those things, she had believed they were true. My folly had been in thinking that truth would never change. Night Eyes had risen and stretched stiffly. Now he came to lie down beside me. He set his head on my knee.
I don't understand. You were ill?
No. Just stupid.
Ah, nothing new there. Well, you haven't died from that so far.
But sometimes it has been a near thing. I took a breath. Tell me about it. I didn't want to hear it, but I knew he had to tell it. Better to get it over with. Hap came with a sigh to sit on the other side of Night Eyes. He picked up a twig from the ground beside him and teased the fire with it. I don't think she meant for me to find out. Her husband doesn't live at Buckkeep. He travelled in to surprise her, to spend Springfest with her. As he spoke, the twig caught fire. He tossed it in. His fingers wandered to idly groom Night Eyes. I pictured some honest old farmer wed to a minstrel in the quiet years of his life, perhaps with children grown from an earlier marriage. He loved her then to make a trip to Buckkeep to surprise her. Springfest was traditionally for lovers old and new. His name is Dewin, Hap went on, and he's some sort of a kin to Prince Dutiful. A distant cousin or something. He's a tall man, always dressed very grand. He wore a cloak twice as big around as it need be, collared with fur. And he wears silver on both wrists. He's strong, too. At the Springfest dancing, he lifted Starling right up and swung her around, and all the folk stood back to watch them. Hap was watching my face as he spoke. I think he found my obvious dismay comforting. I should have known you didn't know. You wouldn't cuckold a grand man like that. I wouldn't cuckold any man, I managed to say, not knowingly. He sighed, as if relieved. So you've taught me. Boyishly, his mind instantly reverted to how it had affected him. I was upset when I saw them kiss. I'd never seen anyone except you and Starling kiss like that. I thought she was betraying you. And then, when I heard him introduced as her husband, he cocked his head at me. It really hurt my feelings. I thought that you knew and didn't care. I thought that perhaps all those years you had taught me one thing and done another. I wondered if you thought me so dull I'd never discover it, if you and Starling laughed about it as if it were a joke for me to be so stupid. It built up in my mind until I began to question everything you'd ever taught me about anything. He looked back at the fire. It felt horrible to be so betrayed. I was glad to hear him sorted out in this way. Better far that he consider only what it meant to him rather than how it could cut me. Let him follow his own thoughts where they would lead. My own mind was moving in another direction, creaking like an old cart dragged out of a shed and newly greased for spring. I resisted the turning of the wheels that led me to an inevitable conclusion. Starling was married. Why not? She'd had nothing to lose and all to gain. A comfortable home with her grand lord, some minor title, no doubt, wealth and security for her old age and for him, a lovely and charming wife, a celebrated minstrel, and he could bask in her reflected glory and enjoy the envy of other men. And when she wearied of him, she could take to the road, as minstrels always did, and have a fling with me, and neither man ever the wiser. Neither? Could I assume that there were only two of us? Did you think you were the only one she bedded?
A direct, spoken lad, Hap. I wondered what questions he had asked Starling on the ride home.
I suppose I didn't think about it at all, I admitted.
So many things were easier to live with if you didn't give them much thought. I suppose I'd known that Starling shared herself with other men. She was a minstrel. They did such things. So I had excused my bedding with her to myself and indirectly to Hap. She never spoke of it. I never asked. And her other lovers were hypothetical beings, faceless and bodiless. They were certainly not husbands, however. She was vowed to him and him to her. That made all the difference to me.
What will you do now?
An excellent question. One I had been carefully not considering. I'm not sure, I lied.
Starling said that it was none of my business, that it hurt no one. She said that if I told you, I'd be the cruel one, hurting you, not her. She said that she'd always been careful not to hurt you, that you'd have enough pain in your life. When I said that I thought you had a right to know, she said you had a greater right not to know.
Starling's clever tongue. She'd left him no way to feel right about himself. Hap looked at me now, his mismatched eyes loyal as a hound's, and he waited for me to pass judgment on him. I told him the truth. I'd rather know the truth from you than have you watch me be deceived.
Have I hurt you, then?
I shook my head, slowly. I've hurt myself, boy. And I had. I'd never been a minstrel. I had no right to a minstrel's ways. Those who make a living with their fingers and tongues have flintier hearts than the rest of us, I suppose. Sooner a kindly wolverine than a faithful minstrel, so the saying goes. I wondered if Starling's husband paid heed to it.
I thought you would be angry. She warned me that you might get angry enough to hurt her. Did you believe that?
That stung as sharply as the revelation.
He took a quick breath, hesitated again, and then he said quickly, You've a temper, and I've never had to tell you something that might hurt you, something that might make you feel stupid.
Perceptive lad, more so than I had thought.
I am angry, Hap. I'm angry at myself.
He looked at the fire.
I feel selfish, because I feel better now.
I'm glad you feel better. I'm glad things are easy between us again.
Now, set all that aside and tell me about the rest of Springfest. What did you think of Buckkeep Town?
So he talked, and I listened. He'd seen Buckkeep and Springfest with a boy's eyes, and as he spoke, I realized how greatly both castle and town had changed since my days there. From his descriptions, I knew the city had managed to grow, clawing out building space from the harsh cliffs above it and expanding out onto pilings. He described floating taverns and mercantiles. He talked, too, of traders from Bingtown and the islands beyond it, as well as those from the out-islands. Buckkeep Town had increased its stature as a trade port. When he spoke of the great hall of Buckkeep and the room where he had stayed as Starling's guest, I recognized that a great deal had changed up at the keep as well. He spoke of carpets and fountains, rich hangings on every wall, and cushioned chairs and glittering chandeliers. His descriptions put me more in mind of Regal's fine manor at Tradeford than the stark fortress I had once called home. I suspected Chade's influence there as much as Cotricken's. The old assassin had always been fond of fine things, not to mention comfort. I had already resolved never to return to Buckkeep. Why should it be so daunting to learn that the place I recalled, that grim stronghold of black stone, did not really even exist anymore? Hap had other tales, too, of the towns they had passed through on their way to Buckkeep and back again. One, he told me, put a cold chill in my belly.
I got scared near to death one morning at Hardin Spit, he began, and I did not recognize the name of the village.
I had known dimly that many folk who had fled the coast during the Red Ship years had returned to found new towns, not always on the ashes of the old. I nodded as if I knew the place. Probably the last time I had been through it, it had been no more than a wide place in the road. Hap's eyes were wide as he spoke, and I knew he had, for the moment, forgotten all about Starling's deception.
It was on our way to Springfest. We had spent the night at the inn there. Starling singing for our supper in a room, and they were all so kind and well-spoken to us there that I thought Hard and Spit a very fine place. In the common room, when Starling was not singing, I heard angry talk about a witted one who had been taken for magicking cows, so they would not yield. But I paid little attention to it. It just seemed men talking too loud after too much beer. The inn gave us an upstairs room. I woke up early, much too early for Starling, but I could not sleep any more, so I sat by the window and watched the folk come and go in the streets below. Outside, in the square, folk began to gather. I thought it might be a market or a spring fair, but then they dragged a woman out there, all bruised and bloody. They tied her to a whipping post, and I thought they would flog her. Then I noticed that some of those gathered had brought full baskets of stones. I woke Starling and asked her what it was all about, but she bid me be quiet. There was nothing either of us could do about it. She told me to come away from the window, but I did not. I could not. I could not believe it could happen. I kept thinking someone would come and make them all stop. Tom, she was tied there, helpless. Some man came up and read from a scroll. Then he stood back, and they stoned her. He stopped speaking. He knew that in the villages there were harsh punishments for horse thieves and murderers. He'd heard of floggings and hangings, but he'd never had to watch one. He swallowed in the silence between us. Cold crept through me. Night Eyes whined, and I set a hand to him.
It could just as well have been you.
I know. Hap took a deep breath. I thought I should go down there, that someone should do something, but I was too scared. I was shamed to be so scared, but I couldn't make myself move. I just sat there and watched, and the stones hit her. And she kept trying to hide her head in her arms. I felt sick. Then I heard a sound such as I had never heard before, as if a river rushed through the air. The morning sky dimmed as if storm clouds were blowing in, but there was no wind. It was crows, Tom. A flood of black birds. I'd never seen so many, cawing and screeching, just as they do when they find an eagle or a hawk and set out to roast it. Only they weren't after an eagle. They rose out of the hills behind the town and filled the sky like a black blanket flapping on a clothesline. Then they suddenly fell on the crowd, diving and cawing. I saw one land in a woman's hair and strike at her eyes with his beak. People were running in every direction, screaming and slapping at the birds. They spooked a team and the horses went crazy, dragging their wagon right through the crowd. Everyone was screaming. Even Starling got up to come to the window. Soon the streets were empty of everything save the birds. They perched everywhere, on roofs and window ledges, and they filled the trees so that the branches drooped with their weight. The woman who had been tied, the witted one, she was gone. Just the bloody ropes were left there, tied to the post. Then, all at once, all the birds just lifted and took flight. And then they were gone. His voice dropped to a hush. Later that morning, the innkeeper said that he deemed she had just turned into a bird and flown off with the others. Later, I told myself. Later, I would tell him that wasn't true, that she might have called the birds down to help her escape, but that not even witted ones could change their shape like that. Later, I would tell him he was not a coward for not going down there, that they would only have stoned him alongside her later. This story he was telling now was like poison running from a wound. Best to let it drain unhindered. I picked up the trail of his words again. And they call themselves old blood. The innkeeper said they've begun to have high ideas of themselves. They'd like to come to power, he says, like they did in the days when the piebald prince ruled. But if they do, they'll take vengeance on us all. Those that don't have the wit magic will be their slaves, and if any try to defy them, they'll be thrown to the witted one's beasts. His voice died away to a whisper. He cleared his throat. Starling told me that that was stupid, that witted folk aren't like that. She said that mostly they just want to be left alone, to live quietly. I cleared my throat. I was surprised at the rush of gratitude I felt towards Starling. Well, she's a minstrel. They know many kinds of folk and have many odd corners of knowledge, so you can believe what she told you. He had given me far too much to think about. I could scarcely keep my mind on the rest of his tales. He was intrigued by some wild story that Bingtown was hatching dragons and that soon towns could buy a Bingtown dragon for a watch beast. I assured him that I had seen real dragons and that such tales were not to be believed. More realistic were the rumours that Bingtown's war with Chalced might spread to the six duchies.
"Would a war come here?"
he wanted to know. Young as he was, he had only vague but frightening memories of our war with the Red Ships. Still, he was a boy, and war seemed as interesting an event as Springfest. "Sooner or later, there is always a war with Chalced," I quoted the old proverb to him. "Even when we are not at war with Chalced, there are always border skirmishes and certain amount of piracy and raiding. Don't let it worry you. Shokes and Ripon duchies always take the brunt of it with relish. Shokes duchy would like nothing better than to carve themselves another chunk out of the Duke of Chalced's lands." So the conversation moved to safer and more prosaic news of his Springfest. He told of jugglers who hurled flaming clubs and bare blades hand to hand, recounted the best jests from a bawdy puppet show he'd seen, and told me of a pretty hedge witch named Jinnah, who had sold him a charm against pickpockets and promised some day to visit us here. I laughed aloud when he told me that within the hour the charm had been plucked from him by a sneak thief. He'd eaten pickled fish and liked it very much until he had too much wine one evening and vomited them together. He swore he'd never be able to eat it again. I let him talk on, glad he was finally taking pleasure in sharing his buckkeep adventures with me. Yet every story he told me showed me more plainly that my simple life was no longer suitable for Hap. It was time I found him an apprenticeship and let him strike out on his own. For an instant it was like standing on the lip of an abyss. I must turn Hap over to a master who could teach him a true trade, and I must set Starling out of my life as well. I knew that if I turned her out of my bed, she would not humble herself to come back to me as a friend. All the simple comfort of their companionship over the last few years would vanish. Hap's voice pattered on, his words falling around me like a soft rain. I would miss the boy. I felt the warm weight of the wolf's head as he set it on my knee. He stared steadily into the fire.
"Once you dreamed of a time when it would be only you and me."
A Witbond leaves very little room for polite deception. "I never expected to hunger so for the company of my own kind," I admitted. A brief, lambent glance from his deep eyes.
"Only we are our own kind. That has always been the problem with the links we sought to forge with others. They were wolves or they were human, but they were never our own kind. Not even those who call themselves old blood are as deeply twined as we."
I knew he spoke true. I set my hand to his broad skull and silked his ear through my fingers. I did not think at all. He could not let it be.
"Change comes upon us, Changer. I can feel it at the edge of the horizon, almost smell it. It is like a bigger predator come into our hunting territory. Do you not feel it?"
I feel nothing, but he heard the lie and sighed out a heavy breath. Chapter 3. Partings. The wit is a dirty magic, most often afflicting the children of an unclean household. Although it is often blamed on having congress with beasts, there are other sources for this low magic. A wise parent will not allow his child to play with puppies or kittens that are still at suckle, nor permit his offspring to sleep where an animal sleeps. A child's sleeping mind is most vulnerable to invasion by the dreams of a beast, and hence to taking the tongue of an animal as the language of his heart. Often this foul magic will afflict generations of a household due to their filthy habits. But it is not unknown for a witch child to appear suddenly in the midst of families of the best blood. When this happens, the parents must harden their hearts and do what must be done, for the sake of all the family's children.
They should look, too, amongst their servants to see whose malice or carelessness is the source of this contagion, and the offender should be dealt with accordingly. Sarkogin's Diseases and Afflictions. Shortly before the first dawn birds began to call, Hap drowsed off again. I sat for a brief time by his fire watching him. The anxiety was smoothed from his face. Hap was a calm and simple boy who had never enjoyed conflict. He was not a boy for secrets. I was glad that his telling me about Starling had put him at peace with himself. My own route to peace would be a rockier path. I left him sleeping in the early sunlight by the dying fire. "Keep watch over him," I told Night Eyes. I could feel the aching in the wolf's hips echoing the gnawing pain in my scarred back. Nights in the open were not gentle to either of us any more. Yet I would have gladly lain down on the cold, damp earth rather than go back to my cottage and confront Starling. Sooner is usually better than later when it comes to facing unpleasantness, I told myself. Walking like a very old man, I returned to the cottage. I stopped at the hen house for eggs. My flock was already up and scratching. The rooster flew to the top of the mended roof, flapping his wings twice, and crowed lustily. Morning. Yes. One I dreaded. Inside the cottage, I poked up the fire and put the eggs to boil. I took out my last loaf of bread, the cheese that Shade had brought, and tea herbs. Starling was never an early riser. I had plenty of time to think of what I would say and what I would not say. As I put the room to rights, mostly picking up her scattered belongings, my mind wandered back over the years we had shared. Over a decade it had been, of knowing one another, of thinking I knew her, I corrected myself. Then I damned myself for a liar. I did know her. I picked her discarded cloak from the chair. Her scent was trapped in its good wool, a very fine quality, I told myself. Her husband provided her with the best. The sharpest part of this was that what Starling had done did not surprise me. I was ashamed only of myself, that I had not foreseen it. For 6 years after the cleansing of Buck, I had moved alone through the world. I made no contact with anyone who had known me at Buckkeep. My life as a farseer, as Prince Chivalry's bastard, as Chade's apprentice assassin, was dead to me. I became Tom Badgerlock, and entered wholeheartedly into that new life. As I had long dreamed, I travelled, and my decisions were shared only with my wolf. I found a sort of peace within myself. This is not to say that I did not miss those I had loved at Buckkeep. I did, sometimes savagely. But in missing them, I also discovered my freedom from my past. A hungry man can long for hot meat and gravy without disdaining the simple pleasures of bread and cheese. I put together a life for myself, and if it lacked much of what had been sweet in my old life, it also provided simple pleasures the old life had long denied me. I had been content. Then, one foggy morning about a year after I had settled into the cottage near the ruins of Forge, the wolf and I returned from a hunt to find change waiting in ambush for us. A yearling deer was heavy on my shoulders, making my old arrow scar ache and twinge. I was trying to decide if the comfort of a long soak in hot water was worth the pain of hauling the buckets and the wait for the water to heat, when I heard the unmistakable sound of a shod hoof against stone. I eased our kill to the ground, and then Night Eyes and I ghosted a wide circle around the hut. There was nothing to see but a horse, still saddled, tied to a tree near my door. The rider was likely within our home. The horse flicked her ears as we sidled closer, aware of me, but not yet certain of alarm. "Hang back, my brother. If the horse scents a wolf, she will neigh. If I go very softly, I might get close enough to see inside before she gives any warning." Silent as the fog that cloaked us both, Night Eyes withdrew into a swirl of grey. I circled to the back of our cottage and then glided down to stand close to one wall. I could hear the intruder inside. "A thief?" I heard the clack of crockery and the sound of water being poured. A thump was someone tossing a log on my fire. I knit my brows in puzzlement. Whoever it was, he seemed to be making himself at home.
An instant later, I heard a voice lift in the refrain of an old song, and my heart turned over in me. Despite the years that had passed, I recognized Starling's voice.
"The howling bitch,"
Night Eyes confirmed for me. He'd caught her scent. As always, I winced wryly at how the wolf thought of the minstrel. Let me go first. Despite knowing who it was, I was still wary as I approached my own door. This was no accident. She'd tracked me down. Why? What did she want of me? "Starling," I said, as I opened the door. She spun to confront me, teapot in hand. Her eyes travelled me swiftly, then met my gaze and...
"Fitz!"
she exclaimed happily and lunged at me. She embraced me, and after a moment I put my arms around her as well. She hugged me hard. Like most buck women, she was small and dark, but I felt her wiry strength in her embrace. "Hello," I said uncertainly, looking down at the top of her head. She tilted her face up at me. "Hello," she said incredulously. She laughed aloud at my expression. "Hello." She leaned away from me to set the teapot on the table. Then she reached up, seized my face between her hands, and pulled me down to be kissed. I had just come in from the damp and the cold. The contrast between that and her warm mouth on mine was astonishing, as amazing as having a woman in my arms. She held me close, and it was as if life itself embraced me again. Her scent intoxicated me. Heat rushed through me, and my heart raced. I took my mouth from hers. "Starling," I began. "No," she said firmly. She glanced over my shoulder, then took both my hands and tugged me towards the sleeping alcove of the main room. I lurched after her, drunken with surprise. She halted by my bed and unbuttoned her shirt. When I just stared at her dumbly, she laughed and reached up to untie the laces of mine. "Don't talk yet," she warned me. And she lifted my chilled hand and set it on one of her bared breasts. At that moment, Night Eyes shouldered the door open and came into the cabin. Cold billowed into the warm room as fog. For an instant, he just looked at us. Then he shook the moisture from his coat. It was Starling's turn to freeze.
"The wolf? I'd almost forgotten. You still have him?"
"We are still together, of course." I started to lift my hand from her breast, but she caught my hand and held it there.
"I don't mind, I suppose."
She looked uncomfortable.
"But does he have to be here?"
Night Eyes gave another shake. He looked at Starling and away. The chill in the room was not just from the door standing open.
"The meat will be cold and stiff if I wait for you."
"Then don't wait," I suggested. Stung. He drifted back outside into the fog. I sensed him closing his mind to us. Jealousy or courtesy, I wondered. I crossed the room and shut the door. I stood by it, troubled by Night Eye's reaction. Starling's arms came around me from behind, and when I turned to her embrace, she was naked and waiting. I made no decision. That joining had happened between us in much the same way as night falls upon the land. Thinking back on it, I wondered if she had planned it that way. Probably not. Starling had taken that part of my life with no more thought than she would give to picking a berry by the roadside. It was there. It was sweet. Why not have it? We had become lovers with no declaration of love, as if our bedding was inevitable. Did I love her, even now, after all the years of her coming and going from my life? Thinking such thoughts was as eerie as handling the artifacts Chade had brought from my old life. Once such thoughts had seemed so important to me. Questions of love and honour and duty. I loved Molly. Did Molly love me? Did I love her more than I loved my king? Was she more important to me than my duty? As a youth, I had agonized over those questions. But with Starling, I had never even asked them until now. Yet, as ever, the answers were elusive. I loved her not as a person carefully chosen to share my life, but as a familiar part of my existence. To lose her would be like losing the hearth from the room. I had come to rely on her intermittent warmth. I knew that I had to tell her that I could not continue as before. The dread I felt reminded me of how time had dragged and how I had clenched my soul against the healer digging the arrowhead from my back. I felt the same stiff apprehension of great pain to come. I heard the rustling of my bedding as she awoke. Her footfall was light on the floor behind me. I did not turn to her as I poured the water over the tea. I suddenly could not look at her. Yet she did not come to me nor touch me. After a pause, she spoke. "So, Hap told you?" "Yes," I replied evenly. "And you're determined to let it ruin everything between us?" There seemed no answer to that. Anger surged into her voice. "You've changed your name, but after all these years, you've not changed your ways. Tom Badgerlock is just as straight-laced a prude as Fitzchivalry Farseer was." "Don't," I warned her, not of her tone, but of that name. We had always taken great pains that Hap knew me only as Tom. I knew it was no accident that she spoke that name aloud now, but a reminder that she held my secrets. "I won't," she assured me, but it was a knife sheathed. "I but remind you that you lead two lives, and that you lead them very well. Why begrudge that to me? I don't think of it that way. This is the only life I have now, and I but try to do by your husband as I would wish another man to do by me. Or will you tell me that he knows of me and does not care?" "Exactly the opposite. He does not know, and therefore does not care. And if you look at it carefully, you will see it comes out to exactly the same thing." "Not for me." "Well, for a time, it was the same for you. Until Hap saw fit to ruin it. You've inflicted your stiff standards on yet another young man. I hope you take great pride in knowing you've raised another moralistic, judgmental prig like yourself." Her words slapped me as she began to slam about the room, throwing her things together. I finally turned to look at her. Her colour was very high, her hair tousled from sleep. She wore only my shirt. The hem of it grazed her thighs. She halted when I turned to look at her and stared back at me. She drew herself up as if to be sure I must see all I was refusing. "What does it hurt?" she demanded. "Your husband, if he ever gets word of it," I said quietly. "Hap gave me to understand he's a noble of some kind. Gossip can do more damage to that kind of man than a knife. Consider his dignity, the dignity of his house. Don't make him some old fool taken with a lively younger woman." "Old fool?" She looked perplexed. "I don't... Hap told you he was old?" I felt off balance. "He said he was a grand man." "Grand, yes, but scarcely old. Quite the opposite." She smiled oddly, caught between pride and embarrassment. "He's 24, Fitz. A fine dancer and strong as a young bull. What did you think, that I pastured myself out to warm some elderly lord's bed?" I had. I thought... She was suddenly almost defiant, as if I had belittled her. "He's handsome, and he's charming, and he should have had his pick of any number of women. He chose me. And in my own way, I do truly love him. He makes me feel young and desirable and capable of real passion." "What did I make you feel?" I asked unwillingly, my voice low. I knew I was inviting more pain, but I couldn't stop myself. That puzzled her for a moment. "Comfortable," she said at last, with no thought for my feelings. "Accepted and valued." She smiled suddenly, and her expression cut me. "Generous, giving you what no one else would, and more, worldly and adventurous, like a bright young songbird come to visit a wren." "You were that," I conceded. I looked away from her towards the window. "But no more, starling, never again. Perhaps you think my life a poor thing, but it is mine. I won't steal the crumbs from another man's table. I have that much pride." "You can't afford that kind of pride," she said bluntly. She pushed her hair back from her face. "Look around you, Fitz. A dozen years on your own, and what do you have? A cottage in the forest and a handful of chickens. What do you have for brightness or warmth or sweetness?
only me. Perhaps it's only a day or two of my life, here and there, but I'm the only real person in your life.
Her voice grew harder.
Crumbs from another man's table are better than starving. You need me.
Hap. Night Eyes, I pointed out, coldly.
She dismissed them. An orphan boy I brought to you, and a decrepit wolf.
That she should disparage them so not only affronted me, it forced me to face how differently we perceived things. I suppose that if we had lived together day in and day out, such disagreements would have manifested themselves long ago. But the interludes we had shared had not been ones of philosophical discussions or even practical considerations. We had come together at her convenience, to share my bed and my table. She had slept and eaten and sung and watched me at my tasks in a life she didn't share. The minor disagreements we had were forgotten between one visit and the next. She had brought me Hap as if he were a stray kitten, and given no thought since then as to what we might have become to one another. This quarrel was not only ending what we had shared, but exposing that we had truly shared very little at all. I felt twice devastated by it. Bitter words from a past life came back to me. The fool had warned me.
She has no true affection for Fitz, you know. Only for being able to say she knew Fitz's chivalry.
Perhaps, despite all the years we'd shared, that was still true.
I held my tongue for fear of all I might say. I think she mistook my silence for a wavering in my resolve. She suddenly took a deep breath. She smiled at me wearily.
Oh, Fitz, we need one another in ways neither of us likes to admit.
She gave a small sigh.
Make breakfast. I'm going to get dressed. Things always seem worst in the morning on an empty stomach.
She left the room. A fatalistic patience came over me. I set out the breakfast things as she dressed. I knew I had reached my decision. It was as if Hap's words last night had extinguished a candle inside me. My feelings for Starling had changed that completely. We sat at table together, and she tried to make all seem as it had before, but I kept thinking, this is probably the last time I'll watch how she swirls her tea to cool it, or how she waves her bread around as she talks. I let her talk, and she kept her words to inconsequential things, trying to fix my interest on where she planned to go next and what Lady Amity had worn to some occasion. The more she talked, the further away she seemed from me. As I watched her, I had the strangest sense of something forgotten, something missed. She took another piece of cheese, alternating bites of it and the bread. A sudden realization trickled through me like a drop of cold water down the spine. I interrupted her. You knew Chade was coming to see me. A fraction of a second too late, she lifted her brows in surprise.
Chade? Here?
These were habits of mind I thought I had discarded. Ways of thinking taught to me painstakingly by a skilled mentor in the hours between dusk and dawn during the years of my youth. It was a way of sifting facts and assembling them, a training that let the mind make swift leaps to conclusions that were not conjectures. Begin with a simple observation. Starling had not commented on the cheese. Any cheese was a luxury for the boy and me, let alone a fine, ripe cheese like this one. She should have been surprised to see it on my table, but she was not. She had said nothing of the San Sedge brandy last night, because neither had surprised her. I was both astonished and pleased, in a horrified way, at how swiftly my mind leapt from point to point, until I suddenly looked down on the inevitable landscape the facts formed.
You've never offered to take Hap anywhere before this. You took the boy off to Buckkeep so that Chade could see me alone.
One possible conclusion from that chilled me. In case he had to kill me, there would be no witnesses.
Fitz!
She rebuked me, both angry and shocked. I almost didn't hear her. Once the pebbles of thought had started bounding, the avalanche of conclusions was bound to follow.
All these years, all your visits, you've been his eyes on me, haven't you? Tell me, do you check on Burrick and Nettle several times a year as well?
She looked at me coldly, denying nothing.
I had to seat them out. To give Burrit the horses. You wanted me to do that.
Yes, my mind raced on. The horses would have served as a perfect introduction. Any other gift Burrit would have refused. But Ruddy was rightfully his, a gift from Verity. All those years ago, Starling had told him that the Queen had sent Sooty's colt as well, in token of services done for the Farseers. I looked at her, waiting for the rest. She was a minstrel. She loved to talk. All I need do was provide the silence. She set her bread down. When I am in that area, I visit them, yes. And when I return to Buckkeep, if Chade knows that I've been there, he asks after them, just as he asks after you. And the fool, do you know his whereabouts as well?
No.
The answer was succinct, and I believed it true. But she was a minstrel, and for her the power of a secret was always in the telling of it. She had to add,
"But I think that Burrit does. Once or twice, when I have visited there, there have been toys about, far finer than anything Burrit could afford for Nettle. One was a doll that put me very much in mind of the fool's puppets. Another time there was a string of wooden beads, each carved like a little face."
That was interesting, but I did not let it show in my eyes. I asked her directly the question that was foremost on my mind. Why would Chade consider me a threat to the Farseers? It is the only reason I know that might make him think he must kill me. Something akin to pity came into her face.
You truly believe that, don't you? That Chade could kill you? That I would help by luring the boy away?
I know Chade.
And he knows you.
The words were almost an accusation.
He once told me that you were incapable of entirely trusting anyone, that wanting to trust and fearing to would always divide your soul.
No. I think that the old man simply wanted to see you alone so he could speak freely to you. To have you to himself and to see for himself how you were doing after all your years of silence. She had a minstrel's way with words and tone. She made it seem as if my avoiding Buckkeep had been both rude and cruel to my friends. The truth was, it had been a matter of survival.
"What did Chade talk with you about?" she asked.
Too casually. I met her gaze steadily. "I think you know," I replied, wondering if she did. Her expression changed, and I could see her mind working. So Chade hadn't entrusted the truth of his mission to her. However, she was bright and quick and had many of the pieces. I waited for her to put it together.
"Old blood," she said quietly.
"The piebald threats. There have been many times in my life when I have been shocked and have had to conceal it. That time, I think, was most difficult for me." She watched my face carefully as she spoke. "It is a trouble that has been brewing for a time, and looks to be coming to a boil now. At Springfest, on the night of the minstrels, where all vied to perform for their monarch, one minstrel sang the old song about the piebald prince. You recall it?"
I did.
It told of a princess carried off by a witted one in the form of a piebald stallion. Once they were alone, he took his man's shape and seduced her. She gave birth to a bastard son, mottled dark and light, just as his sire had been. By treachery and spite, her bastard came to the throne to rule cruelly with the aid of his witted cohorts. The entire kingdom had suffered until, so the song said, his cousin, of pure Farseer blood, had rallied 6 noble sons to his cause. At the summer solstice, when the sun stood at noon and the piebald prince's powers were weakest, they fell upon him and slew him. They hanged him, then chopped his body to pieces, then burned the pieces over water to wash his spirit far away, lest it find a home in some beast's body. The song's method of dealing with the piebald prince had become the traditional way to be surely rid of witted ones. Regal had been very disappointed that he had not been able to serve me so. "Not my favourite song," I said quietly.
"Understandably.
However, Sleck sang it well, to much applause, more than his voice truly merits. He has that quaver at the end of his notes that some find endearing, but in truth, it's the sign of a voice with poor control. She suddenly realized she was wandering from her topic. Feelings run high against the witted ones these days. The witted have been restless of late, and one hears wild tales. I have heard that in one village where a witted